Jennifer Davis Page, signing off, and thank you for joining us today.
Je revois la ville en fête et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie. Et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi. Éperdu parmi ces gens qui me bousculent, étourdi, désemparé, je reste là. Quand soudain je me retourne, il se recule et la foule vient me jeter entre ses bras. Emporté par la foule qui nous traîne, nous entraîne, écrasés l'un contre l'autre, nous ne formons qu'un seul corps. Et le flot sans effort nous pousse enchaîner l'un et l'autre, et nous laisse tous deux épanouis, enivrés et heureux. Entraînés par la foule qui s'élance et qui danse une folle farandole, nos deux mains restent soudées. Et parfois soulevés, nos deux corps enlacés s'envolent et retombent tous deux épanouis, enivrés et heureux. Et la joie qu'elle a poussée par son sourire me transperce et rejaillit au fond de moi. Mais soudain, je pousse un cri parmi les rires quand la foule vient l'arracher d'entre mes bras. Emportée par la foule qui nous traîne, nous entraîne, nous éloigne l'un de l'autre, je lutte et je me débat. Mais le son de ma voix s'étouffe dans le rire des autres, et je crie de douleur, de fureur et de rage, et je pleure. Et traînée par la foule qui s'élance et qui danse une folle farandole, je suis emportée au loin. Et je crispe mes poings maudissant la foule qui me vole, l'homme qu'elle m'avait donné que je n'ai jamais retrouvé.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Be sure to tune in to Radio Lost and Found. It's the show that puts the OO in KBOO. Radio Lost and Found is a two-hour media escape of found sounds, forgotten records, outre recordings, and more. Coming to you every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
KBOO.
Radio in San Francisco. This is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges celebrates the release of his new book, The Greatest Evil is War. Hedges spoke in Berkeley last night. It was a mighty powerful speech. And Tony Diaz, founder of Libros Traficante, on the banning and future burning of books in Texas and across America. Diaz is a pioneer in the battle for ethnic studies in U.S. public schools. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We broadcast every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network, coming out of the San Francisco Bay Area, and we are happy to have you along today. And we are always delighted to welcome back to these airwaves our good friend, Tony Diaz. He's a writer, activist. He's a professor. He's the founder of Libro Traficante and the Caravan Against Banned Books. Tony Diaz has a new book. It's called The Tip of the Pyramid, Cultivating Community Cultural Capital. Well, it is good to have you back, Tony Diaz, but it is a battle. The books are under attack. I don't think I've seen the big piles of burnt books yet, but I don't think it's going to be long, Tony.
No, hey, it is great to convene again, and I do want to dispel one rumor. The Libertaficantes are in California right now. We will not be seeking political asylum from Texas because the work is in Texas. Texas right now is rampant with book bans right and left. And Dennis, here's what's happened. These right-wing champions of censorship have studied our movements, and they're navigating this new terrain to keep hands, to keep books out of the hands of our community. And here's what I mean. If you look at the ban of ethnic studies in Arizona 10 years ago, which my book touches on, but my book isn't just about that, because I'm positive right-wingers will never ban Mexican-American studies again because we school them. However, like you're suggesting, they've come up with new ways, new tactics, and there's now a representative in Texas who's come up with a way to challenge 800 books at a time by creating this crazy list. So the trick is we got to keep talking to each other, and to me, it's a sign that we're winning, because these people that want to silence us, that are championing censorship, they're using every trick in the book, including lying about curriculums. I don't want to call it an anti-critical race theory campaign anymore, because that's not what it is. These are censorship bills in Texas that are spreading to many states, but they're scaring people, making them think that there's kindergarten kids taking graduate school level courses. I tell you what, in Texas, these schools are in such conditions because of the Republicans in charge. They're sabotaging the education system so much that the students can't even read grade level material, let alone curriculums from graduate school level, like critical race theory. So it's good news and bad news, Dennis. But I think the powerful part is that Texas and California are uniting. People are waking up, and these far right wingers wouldn't be working so hard if they didn't know that their days were numbered.
Well, let me just press you a little bit on that. You're in California
sure.
now, and we thought we had a progressive governor, but he has already vetoed. He has really moved to water down and then veto ethnic studies programs here in California. You've had some extraordinary work in preparation for a major program that would have been in the schools, but we didn't have the governor with us. Why do you suppose that would be? Does he not realize the importance of ethnic studies? This is California.
How about this? At the end of the day, and I read about it in the book, we have to believe and only and exclusively in community culture capital, the power of community, our neighborhoods, our families, our histories, our stories, and our voices. Why? Because here's some quick examples. Texas, of course, is running rampant with book bans, okay? So that's a given. However, if you look at California, there's other sinister ways to keep our community from having access to books. So, for example, we've been visiting some book deserts. So we went to East Palo Alto, and we've been doing a book drive for a grammar school, and we'll be working with them to keep bringing them books, because that's a book desert in the middle of Silicon Valley. So here you have this barrio bordering probably one of the most powerful and wealthiest areas, if not in the nation, if not in the country, possibly the world, yet access to our stories is prevented through different tactics. And I guess what I want to get at is that there's always going to be this attempts to sabotage voices, by different parties in different ways in different states, we have to keep pushing. And I think that's really what these book banners want to do. When they sabotage ethnic studies, when they silence voices, they don't want our youth empowered, and they don't want to see us pushing. And let me add something else to that, Dennis, because you want to dig even deeper.
Hello? Did we lose Tony? I think we... All right, let's see if we can get Tony back. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with writer, activist, professor Tony Diaz. He is the founder of Libro Traficante and the Libro Traficante Caravan. You may remember that, now it's not just Tucson, but years ago we were in Tucson. The Flashpoints team was there to document the banning of the ethnic studies program. In fact, we were there as authorities came and took the books that the kids had been using and sharing with their families, literally took the books out of the classrooms. So we've been monitoring this. Now, of course, we see an incredible amount of censorship. I think we've got you back on, Tony Diaz, and you were just going through the litany of new ways to censor the people. So maybe you can go on.
No, and you wanted to press the point, which I think is important, because the other thing is that it's not just enough for Chicanas and Chicanos to have access to their stories, to the books, and to an education. Let's break it down even further. Some of those folks have to give up their access to the community to move up, let's say, the corporate ladder. And the more they do that, the further they get from the community. One thing I say is we're allowed to prosper but not rule. So they are then at a higher income bracket, but they're not running these corporations, but they're separated from the community. And what happens then is that that community doesn't have that particular cultural accelerator that can help them. And also sometimes those are the very people that corporations will hire in order to gain access to our community on their terms. Now, I'm not saying that it's bad for our community to progress in different fields. What my book is about is staying connected to the community and ultimately our terms on our terms. So that's something that you're touching on, is that yes, in California, you do have the ethnic studies mandate now for high school, but you also have to now make sure that the teachers are qualified and impassioned, because it can be reduced to this corporate curriculum as well. And, you know, one thing I say is lawyers contract language, poets liberate it. That's really what I think we're all after, is that this moment where the youth can liberate language in themselves for the good of all others. And that's really what we're after. But we cannot rest ever, Dennis. But it's also thrilling. It's also thrilling to get to convene with you, our brother and sister in California, and to see the new voices unleashed, which is happening. You know, I want to give a shout out to the Downtown Youth Wellness Center, which is going to be working with us to develop a library for their constituents.
Well, that's beautiful. I do want to take you back to Texas. There's a couple of issues. I'm not sure. I learned very quickly after I became a teacher, a young teacher, that most of the textbooks for America were manufactured in Texas. And I learned early that if I wanted to teach slavery, I wrote my own chapters, because these were flaming with racism, these books. They were brand new. You'd come and you'd break open the box and new books for the kids, but old stories. Old tales of racism and nothing to work with. I threatened to burn one of these books once. it was not a good idea, but clearly, it's amazing, and I don't think people realize the nature of racism as it comes in through the textbooks, or maybe they do, but it's the same old for so many years. So how do you battle that in a world where you've got a governor who essentially is still covering up for the slaughter of children in a school district that where he had at least partial responsibility for the slaughter.
Well, and that's a major issue because, as you're pointing out, right-wing Republican governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, he is more likely to ban a book than to ban assault rifles. And you're referring to when he was there in Uvalde lying to the community about what just transpired with the slaughter. And again, my heart is still aching for the families of Uvalde, but he showed his bias, his incompetency, and how quick he is to lie at that time. And he's running for election right now. So it's good for listeners to know that that's at stake in Texas. But what he's doing instead of governing is he is stoking all these fears in communities, including sabotaging education. So not only did you refer to the problem with the content in textbooks, he's basically helping flame these censorship bills, these censorship policies, where you've got kindergarten to 12th grade teachers, librarians, students, and parents being bullied from adopting books about our culture and community. And also, Dennis, I want to make people aware of this. The terrible lieutenant governor, his right-winger named Dan Patrick, he's also up for election. He has said clearly that he, in the next legislative session, which means if he wins in November, the next time he gets his hands on the legislative session, and he has a lot of power, which we might get into, he said he is going to go after professors in college who teach critical race theory, which is actually a curriculum at higher ed. He said he's going to go after tenure. And honestly, most parents might not care about that. But what that signals to educators from other states that we may want in Texas to help edify our students, they're not going to come to Texas anymore. And now, instead of just bullying educators kindergarten to 12th grade, they're now going to bully the higher ed professors as well if he has his way. And I want to remind folks, to your point, they called a special session to ban books, to go after trans families, and to sabotage the voting access of our communities. But they have yet to call a special session to regulate assault rifles after the slaughter in Uvalde. That's what we're dealing with. So Dennis, how do we organize against that? It is up to the artists and community, the activists, to keep pushing. That's one reason we're here in California, is to convene with other activists, community members. One, to find out how we can work together. Two, to team up. And three, to keep spreading the word, because the people of Texas, we need everybody from, you know, every state, especially California. We need them to have our back now. We'll have their back later. But the belly of the beast right now, the battle for democracy, is in Texas, and it's a very real issue. It's life or death, Dennis.
It really, and you know what was amazing to me? We're just about out of time. We're going to obviously keep talking and talking and fighting this together. But it was amazing when that first press conference after when the governor began, Governor Cover-Up began his procedure to make sure nobody really was going to ever find out, or at least for a long time, what happened in that slaughter. And Beto O'Rourke showed up. Do you remember that? And confronted the governor. And the you know, Mr. Texas Ranger there started screaming and cursing Beto out, because they really were. He realized, old boy sheriff over there, that he had to shut down Beto O'Rourke, because this is where the lie is most effective, right at the beginning. And they've been lying about that situation ever since. You know what I'm saying? 400 cops, mm-hmm. and they were all looking at their cell phones.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that was a really powerful moment, because It was Beto O'Rourke, who is a candidate for the Texas governor's seat, calling out the lies, the racism, the injustice. And I want to say one thing, because I don't want to leave your listeners depressed. The people of Uvalde are standing up heroically. They've been chasing off many of the officials that were responsible for their ineptitude. The way Beto was speaking up and telling truth to power, the parents are doing that as well, right and left, with the fury of the hurt in their hearts. And I mean, people couldn't blame them if they just wanted to heal on their own. They are organizing voting drives. They are running off some of these officials. And I think they've started another movement where people are really now pressing these officials to tell the truth. And despite all that, the Texas governor has not called a special session to ensure that 18-year-olds have access to assault rifles. He will not get rid of that law. And instead, he's focusing on other issues such as, again, these culture wars, which are bogus. So, but I want to say, the people of Texas are inspired by the gente of Uvalde, and they're pushing a big change. So there's going to be some prizes in this next election, up and down the ballot. But the people of Texas still need support from all over. So I hope that people will stay aware of that. Thank you so much for spreading the news. And I think there's going to be some shakeups.
Well, you know, Tony, I'm going to call a special session of Flashpoints, and nice. I'm going to invite you to co-host it, and we're going to do it from Uvalde. We'll get a few guests, and we'll once again put the marker down in terms of where that battle is. I've been wanting to do that. You know, I started in this world as a teacher, and I haven't been able to breathe right ever since watching that one unfold. And I'm here, so I can't even begin to imagine what those parents must have felt as those freaking cops. Not only did they not do anything, but they kept them from saving their own children. Really, I'm never getting over that. I'm going to need physical therapy for pounding my fist against the wall. But thank you for trying to go out of here positive. But the positive is we'll meet you in Uvalde. I'm sure there'll be there'll be plenty to talk about then. Thank you for being with us, Tony Diaz. How do people get in touch with you? What's the best way to follow you, your work?
They can visit the website librotraficante.com, or they can go to that same name on the username for Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. But we look forward to uniting.
Yes, we do. All right, well, thank you. Be safe. We'll talk to you soon. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to skip the musical break. We're running late. I'm sorry, Mike. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we are now very proud to have had in our midst last night in the Bay Area, in Berkeley, Chris Hedges, Pulitzer Prize winning writer. He's got a new book, The Greatest Evil is War. And he's a mighty powerful writer, one of the most important writers of our time, social critics of our time. Listen to this.
Thank you. What's that? No, I'm going to read. Thank you very much. When I finished writing War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, it was not cathartic. It was one of the most difficult things I've ever done. There were days when I couldn't write. I would just cry all day. It was written out of my own experience as a war correspondent for 20 years. And it's not a memoir. In fact, I was quite deliberate in that every time I brought myself into that book, it was to expose a moral failing. I'd read enough memoirs by war correspondents to see how self-aggrandizing they were, and I didn't want to do that. And then the book, neither I nor the publisher, was a small publisher, thought it would sell. It did. It sold hundreds of thousands of copies. And then the big publishers, who have dollar signs in their eyes, wanted me to write another book on war, and I refused because I didn't want to dilute what I had done, and also because I didn't want to essentially narrow the focus of my writing to just produce one book on war after another. This book is different. It looks at the experiences of people who come out of war to describe, I think, some of the most salient points of what it is to be in war. One of the chapters I'm going to read is called Corpses, When the Bodies Come Home. It's with a father whose 20-year-old Marine Corps son is killed, Wounds That Never Heal. That's Thomas Young, who was a quadriplegic and then wrote the last letter. Actually, he couldn't hold a pen. He dictated it, and I wrote it out for him to Cheney and Bush before he was going to unhook his feeding tube and die. But I'm going to read two small sections of this book, and then we'll talk with Mickey about it. Preemptive war, whether in Iraq or Ukraine, is a war crime. It does not matter if the war is launched on the basis of lies and fabrications, as was the case in Iraq, or because of the breaking of a series of agreements with Russia, including the promise by Washington not to extend NATO beyond the borders of a unified Germany, not to deploy thousands of NATO troops in Central and Eastern Europe, and not to meddle in the internal affairs of nations on Russia's border, as well as the refusal to implement the Minsk peace agreement. The invasion of Ukraine would, I expect, never have happened if these promises have been kept. Russia has every right to feel threatened, betrayed, and angry. But to understand is not to condone. The invasion of Ukraine under post-Nuremberg laws is a criminal war of aggression. I know the instrument of war. War is not politics by other means. It is demonic. I spent 2 decades as a war correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans, where I covered the wars in Bosnia and Kosovo. I carry within me the ghosts of dozens of those swallowed up in the violence, including my close friend, Reuters correspondent Kurt Schork, who was killed in an ambush in Sierra Leone with another friend, Miguel Gil Moreno de Mora. I know the chaos and disorientation of war, the constant uncertainty and confusion. In a firefight, you are only aware of what is happening a few feet around you. You desperately, and not always successfully, struggle to figure out where the firing is coming from to avoid being hit. I have felt the helplessness and paralyzing fear, which years later descend on me like a freight train in the middle of the night, leaving me wrapped in coils of terror, my heart racing, my body dripping with sweat. I have heard the wails of those convulsed by grief as they clutch the bodies of friends and family, including children. I hear them still. It does not matter the language, Spanish, Arabic, Hebrew, Dinka, Serbo-Croatian, Albanian, Ukrainian, Russian. Death cuts through the linguistic barriers. I know what wounds look like, legs blown off, heads imploded into a bloody, pulpy mass, gaping holes in stomachs, pools of blood, cries of the dying, sometimes for their mothers, and the smell of death, the supreme sacrifice made for flies and maggots. I was beaten by Iraqi and Saudi secret police. I was taken prisoner by the Contras in Nicaragua, who radioed back to their base in Honduras to see if they should kill me. And again in Basra, after the first Gulf War in Iraq, never knowing if I would be executed, under constant guard, and often without food, drinking out of mud puddles. The primary lesson in war is that we, as distinct individuals, do not matter. We become numbers, fodder, objects. Life, once precious and sacred, becomes meaningless, sacrificed to the insatiable appetite of Mars. No one in wartime is exempt. We were expendable. Eugene Sledge wrote of his experiences as a Marine in the South Pacific in World War II. It was difficult to accept. We come from a nation and a culture that values life and the individual. To find oneself in a situation where your life seems of little value is the ultimate in loneliness. It is a humbling experience. Sledge recalls a young Marine officer who had one ghoulish, obscene tendency of urinating in the mouths of Japanese corpses. The landscape of war is hallucinogenic. Sledge calls it the kaleidoscope of the unreal. It defies comprehension. War, like the Holocaust, as Barbara Foley wrote, is unknowable. Its full dimensions are inaccessible to the ideological framework that we have inherited from the liberal era. You have no concept of time in a firefight, a few minutes, a few hours. War in an instant obliterates homes and communities, all that was once familiar, and leaves behind smoldering ruins and a trauma that you carry for the rest of your life. I have tasted enough of war, enough of my own fear. My body turned to jelly. To know that war is always evil, the purest expression of death, dressed up in patriotic cant about liberty and democracy, and sold to the naive as a ticket to glory, honor, and courage. It is a toxic and seductive elixir. Those who survive, as Kurt Vonnegut wrote, struggle afterwards to reinvent themselves and their universe, which on some level will never make sense again. Walt Whitman, who tended wounded soldiers in hospitals during the Civil War, wrote in a heading in his notebook, "The real war will never get in the books." Its interior history will not only never be written, Whitman argues, its practicality, minutiae of deeds and passions will never be even suggested. War destroys all systems that sustain and nurture life, familial, economic, cultural, political, environmental, and social. Once war begins, no one, even those nominally in charge of waging war, knows what will happen, how the war will develop, how it can drive armies and nations towards suicidal folly. There are no good wars, none. This includes World War II, which has been sanitized and mythologized to celebrate American heroism, purity, and goodness. If truth is the first casualty in war, ambiguity is the second. The bellicose rhetoric embraced and amplified by the American press, demonizing Vladimir Putin and elevating the Ukrainians to the status of demigods, demanding more robust military intervention, along with the crippling sanctions designed to bring down Putin's government, is infantile and dangerous. That the inverse version of this conflict is true in the Russian media fuels the insanity. There were no discussions about pacifism in the basements in Sarajevo when we were being hit with hundreds of Serbian shells a day and under constant sniper fire. It made sense to defend the city. It made sense to kill or be killed. The Bosnian Serb soldiers in the Drina Valley, Vukovar, and Srebrenica had amply demonstrated their capacity for murderous rampages, including the gunning down of hundreds of soldiers and civilians and the wholesale rape of women and girls. But this did not save any of the defenders in Sarajevo from the poison of violence, the soul-destroying force that is war. I knew a Bosnian soldier who heard a sound behind a door while patrolling on the outskirts of Sarajevo. He fired a burst from his AK-47 through the door. A delay of a few seconds in combat can mean death. When he opened the door, he found the bloody remains of a 12-year-old girl. His daughter was 12. He never recovered. The second part is called Corpses. Jessica Goodell grew up in a middle-class home near Chautauqua Lake in upstate New York. Her father was a lawyer, and her mother worked at home. But her universe fractured when she was 16 and her parents divorced. She could barely continue the motions of everyday existence. She was accepted at Ithaca College her senior year. But just before graduation, a uniformed Marine came to her high school. He told her he had come to find tough men. And what about tough women, she asked. By that afternoon, she was in the Marine recruiting office. She told the recruiter she wanted to be part of a tank crew, but was informed that women were prohibited from operating tanks. She saw a picture of a Marine standing next to a vehicle with a huge hydraulic arm and two smaller forklift arms. She signed up to be a heavy equipment mechanic, although she knew nothing about heavy equipment. 3 years later, while stationed at the Marine Corps Air Ground Combat Center in the desert town of 29 Palms, California, she volunteered to serve in the Marine Corps' first official mortuary affairs unit at El Tagam Air Base in Iraq. Her job for 8 months was to process dead Marines, collect and catalog their bodies and personal effects. She put the remains in body bags and placed the bags in metal boxes. Before being shipped to Dover Air Force Base, the boxes were stored often for days in a refrigerated unit known as a reefer. Her unit processed 6 suicides. The suicide notes, she told me, almost always cited hazing. Marines who were overweight or unable to do the physical training were subjected to withering verbal and physical abuse. They were called fat nasties and bags. They were assigned to other Marines as slaves. Many were forced to run until they vomited, or to bear crawl, walk on all fours, the length of a football field and back. This would be followed by sets of monkey fingers bending down, grabbing the ankles, crouching like a baseball catcher, and then standing up again, and other exercises that went on until the Marines collapsed. Goodell's unit was sent to collect the bodies of the Marines who killed themselves. We went through everything, she told me. We would get everything that the body had on it when the Marine died. Everyone had a copy of the rules of engagement in their left breast pocket. You found notes that people had written to each other. You found lists. Lists were common. The things they wanted to do when they got home, or food they wanted to eat. The most difficult was pictures. Everyone had a picture of their wife or their kids or their family. And then you had the younger kids, who might be 18 years old, and they had prom pictures, or pictures next to what I imagine were their first cars. Everyone had a spoon in their flak jacket. There were pens and trash and wrappers and MRE food. All of it would get sent back to the Marines' homes. We all had the idea that at any point, this could be us on the table. I think Marines thought we went over there to die, and so people wrote letters saying, if I die, I want you to know I love you. I want my car to go to my younger brother, things like that. They carried those letters on their bodies. We had a Marine that we processed, and going through his wallet, we had a picture of a sonogram of a fetus his wife had sent him. And a lot of Marines had tattooed their vital information under an armpit. It was called a meat tag. Some things were not uncommon enough, like a suicide note, she continued. We had a Marine who was in a port-a-john when he blew his face off. We had another Marine who shot himself through the neck. Often they would do it in the corner of a bunker or an abandoned building. We had a couple that did it in the port-a-johns. We had to go in and peel and pull off chunks of flesh and brain tissue that had sprayed the walls. We sent the suicide notes home with the bodies. We had the paperwork to do fingerprinting, but we started getting bodies in which there weren't any hands, or we would get bodies that were just meat. Very quickly, it became irrelevant to have fingerprinting, to have a fingerprinting page to fill out. By the time we would get a body, it might have been a while, and rigor mortis had already set in. Their hands were usually clenched, as if they were still holding their rifle. We received a call one day that an IED exploded under an army convoy that was crossing a bridge. It had literally shot a 7-ton truck over the side and down into a ravine. We had on our white plastic suits and face masks and our gloves, and I was with a Marine named Pineda. I was coming around the Humvee, and there was a spot on the ground that was a circle. I looked at it, and I thought, well, something must have exploded here or near here. I looked in and saw a boot. Then I noticed the boot had a foot in it. The body of the assistant driver was trapped in the vehicle. All of his body was in the vehicle. We had to crawl in there to get it out. Pineda and I pulled the burnt upper torso from the truck. Then we removed a leg. Some of the remains had to be scooped up by putting our hands together as though we were cupping water. That was very common. A lot of the deaths were from IEDs or explosions. You might have an upper torso, but you needed to scoop the rest of the remains into a body bag. It was very common to have body bags that when you picked them up, they would sink in the middle because they were filled with flesh. She wrote, "Our platoon was to the Marines what the Marines are to much of America. We did things that had to be done, but no one wanted to know about it. The other Marines knew what we did, but they did not want to think it could happen to them. We were different from the other Marines. The smell of death permeated our clothes, hair, skin, fingers. Our camis would be stained with blood or with brains. When you scoop up the meat, it would often get on the cuffs of our shirts. You could smell it, even after you took off your gloves. We weren't washing our camis every day. Your cuff comes to your face when you eat. We had a constant smell, like rotten meat, which I guess is what it was, since often the bodies had been in the sun and the heat for a long time. The sun does horrible things to dead skin. It makes the skin slide off the body. When the man is lifted, the skin detaches itself from the layer beneath and slides around on itself. We lost two men from our original platoon who said they couldn't or wouldn't do it anymore and left. One would take a box of NyQuil tablets every day and drink as much cold medicine as he could get his hands on, but that only seemed to make matters worse. He had gone out on a particularly difficult convoy to a tank that had been blown up, obliterated except for the tracks, leaving thousands of body parts, fingers and testicles and ears and tiny scraps of tissue to be collected. It was shortly after that when I heard that he was medevaced out. One of our tougher days occurred after a platoon of Marines was on a security patrol. When they finished, they did a head count and realized that two Marines were missing. An investigation charted the route the platoon had followed, and we were sent out to find them. At one point, the Marines were walking along the shore of a lake. Navy divers accompanied us, and soon they found the two. By the time they were pulled from the lake, they had been submerged for quite a while. The water made the remains swell. One man was so bloated and misshapen that we had difficulty carrying him properly in the litter. His neck was as wide as his bloated head, and his stomach jutted out like a barrel. His testicles were the size of cantaloupes. His face was white and puffy and thick, not fat, but thick. It was unreal. He looked like a movie prop with thick, gray, waxy skin and the thick, purple lips. We couldn't stop looking at these bodies because they were so out of proportion and so disfigured, and because, still, they looked like us. One time, several Marines were killed at once. Our Marines returned to the bunker with 7 or 8 body bags filled with flesh. We had clean body bags set up so we could sort the flesh. Sometimes things come in with name tags, or sometimes one is Hispanic and you could tell who was Hispanic and who was the white guy. We tried separating flesh, It was ridiculous. We would open a body bag, and there was nothing but vaporized flesh. There were not four hands or a whole leg in a bag. We tried to distribute the mush evenly throughout the bags. We had the last body bag come in. We opened it up, and it was filled with the heads. I looked at four before looking away. Not only did we have to look at them, we had to pick them up and figure out who it belonged to. The eyes were looking back at us. We saw so much throughout the 8 months of the program, and we managed to get used to a lot of it, but the heads worked the other way. They affected us more strongly as time passed. On another night, she and Pineda were assigned to process a body. He was fully dressed in his camis, and his whole body was intact. His hands were lying folded across his stomach. I looked at his chest and saw that it was moving. I spun around and hid. He wasn't dead. He wasn't dead. And I didn't know what to do. The doc said, "Just wait." "Just wait?" "Wait for what?" I asked. "There's nothing we can do," the doc said. "Just wait." "People don't wait for this sort of thing," I protested to Pineda. "What are we waiting for? What if this Marine was your brother? Would we wait?" Pineda and I stood there for a couple of minutes that passed like hours until the young man died. I stormed out of the bunker. I just walked out, which is something Marines cannot do, but I was so angry. And I was just a kid who 2 or 3 years earlier had been playing the saxophone in high school band.
Thanks so much again for everyone being here this evening for this really important conversation and this really important book. Kevin is going to come around with some note cards. Is that right, Kevin? Yeah. And so we're going to collect comments and or questions from you all. So please feel free to participate, and then I will do my best to collect, curate, and then get to all of your questions and comments for Chris Hedges. In the meantime, we're going to have a brief conversation about the book, and I want to start, Chris. Since you said that you hadn't wanted to do another book about war, and it had been quite some time, what brought you back to do this book?
Well, the jingoism around Ukraine, which was nauseating, is nauseating, because I know the landscape of war, and there's a deep cynicism in terms of fueling this proxy war, because it's the Ukrainians who will bleed, and the Russians, the families of the Russians, for what? And it's to degrade the Soviet or the Russian military, and if possible, remove Putin from office. It goes back to the very cynical strategy Brzezinski employed in Afghanistan to drive the Soviets out by giving, I think, a total of $9 billion, maybe more, where the Saudis were also giving money through the ISI to support the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And so I think the cheerleading that took place for the war in Ukraine, the utter lack of the refusal to acknowledge that we had committed a massive war crime in Iraq, also invading a sovereign country that did not threaten its neighbors, much less us, on a false pretext, on lies, it kind of evoked, you know, those very deep passions that one carries when they come out of a war zone. So, and this book is different from the first book in that there's not really much about me in there. It's really about the human detritus might not be the right word, of war. And those are the lifelong wounds and suffering that war leaves behind through reporting with Jessica and all sorts of others, Thomas Young and many others.
So, Chris, when Russia illegally invaded Ukraine, you at the time had a program on Contact, was on RT America, and part and parcel with wars, even proxy wars, is controlling the narrative and censoring people who ask questions or bring up historical context. Could you share with us what happened to your program?
Right, so my program on Contact, I had a program on Telesur, and when the governments in Argentina and other countries which funded Telesur went right-wing, they cut off the funding, and so the Telesur program went off the air. RT asked if they could essentially repackage and have the same show. Probably 70% of my interviews are with authors. And I initially said no, and then the head of RT came to Princeton and promised, and they kept their promise, that I would have complete editorial control. It wasn't a show about Russia. It was the same thing with Telesur. It was a critique of America, American Empire, a lot of shows about Julian Assange, who's a friend of mine, about the war crimes, and David Harvey was on neoliberalism. And but what happened was, after RT was shut down, then YouTube erased or removed all 6 years of my archive. Although, again, there was not one show on Russia, and none of my shows violated the supposed guidelines of YouTube. But what it did, of course, was ask the very uncomfortable questions that the state doesn't want asked. We know why they went after RT, and it wasn't because of Russian propaganda. In 2017, the Director of National Intelligence report was issued, 22 pages long. 7 pages were dedicated to RT, and they were quite specific about what they didn't like. And what they didn't like was that we were giving voices to Black Lives Matter activists, anti-fracking activists, third-party candidates, et cetera. And so that's why they shut it down. I mean, I don't own a television, so I knew what my show did. I don't know what was on the rest of the network, but I was certainly against shutting it down because, and I've been in war. I can tell you both sides lie like they breathe. The Russians lie and the Ukrainians lie. But I didn't feel that the public was served by not hearing the Russian narrative. I was in Eastern Europe in 1989. I covered the revolutions in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Romania. So I was acutely aware of the promises that had been made to Gorbachev not to expand NATO beyond the borders of a unified Germany. We all talked about the peace dividend, which shows you how naive we were. The war industry had no intention of reducing the staggering sums that it loots from the U.S. taxpayer. And NATO should have been rendered obsolete. I mean, formed in 1989 to prevent Soviet expansion into Central and Eastern Europe. So, but none of that came to pass because war is a business. There were billions and billions of dollars to be made by expanding NATO throughout Eastern and Central Europe. After 2014, Ukraine became a de facto NATO country. We know from the WikiLeaks publication of the diplomatic cables that Burns and others were against the expansion of NATO, especially into the Ukraine, because it was essentially baiting Russia into a conflict, which doesn't excuse what Russia did. What they did is a war crime. What they're doing is a war crime. But in the same way that if we want to understand what the rise of fascism, we have to look at the Versailles Treaty, and there are historical antecedents that go into it. So George Kennan, for instance, said that the expansion of NATO into Eastern and Central Europe was the greatest blunder of the post-Cold War era. I mean, I never thought I'd see the day where I agree with Henry Kissinger, who, of course, should be locked up, but he's right. Once you open the Pandora's box of war, you never know where it's going to go. I mean, that the Middle East, the 20 years of the debacles in the Middle East should have taught us that. And we're flirting with a nuclear war. I mean, all we need is, so Russia has said that it would strike at arms shipments that are coming into the Ukraine, and there's been good reporting, including on CBS, although they took it down. But they did a report that they estimated only 30% of the weapons were actually making it to the Ukrainian army, and the rest were siphoned off by black marketeers and warlords, and God knows where those weapons are going to end up. You don't know what could happen. So if, for instance, there's a convoy of weapon systems coming in from Poland and there's a strike and it's on Polish territory, does that trigger a war with NATO? You don't control the narrative of war once it starts. And that was interesting. That was a point Kissinger made, and he was right. And Kissinger said, you know, there has to be land for peace and negotiations now before it spirals out of control. And that's certainly, having spent 20 years of my life in war, that's my concern.
So you write in the book a lot about, you mention, of course, the military-industrial complex. You mention the impetus for war and endless profiteering. You, of course, mention George Orwell later in the book, at how Oceania is at war with Eurasia and allied with East Asia. The alliance then suddenly reversed. Eurasia becomes an ally of Oceania, and East Asia is the enemy. The point is not who's being fought. The point is maintaining the state of fear and the mass mobilization of the public. War and national security are used to justify the surrender of citizenship, the crushing of dissent, and the expanding the powers of state. So the point is to keep the war going, never ending. And the war of terror, not the war on terror, has done that for the past now over 20 years since 9/11. So what do you see as a possible end game in terms, you mentioned, you alluded to the atomic clock, you alluded to the problems of nuclear war. We're closer now than we were even going back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, total annihilation of the entire planet, all living things. The thing that struck me about this book, Chris Hedges, is we haven't really had a book like this that was so powerfully and staunchly anti-war. And so what do you see as being the possibilities of getting a very serious, given what I just read from your book here, the point is to keep the war going. There doesn't seem to be much of a large anti-war movement here in the U.S. Since the beginning of Iraq, and it kind of dissipated. So,
it didn't dissipate. It decided that it was going to elect Kerry, and therefore it committed collective suicide and never reconstituted itself. You know, the whole Orwell's point was played out in the Middle East. So, you know, we want to overthrow Assad in Syria, and then the caliphate and ISIS become strong, so we start bombing them, in essence acting as Assad's air force, and large numbers of Hezbollah were fighting with the Syrians, so in essence Hezbollah's air force. When the Sunni insurgents become threatened to overrun Iraq, Iran sends in all sorts of militias, and they're a de facto ally of the United States in the war against the Sunnis. It's all upside down. It doesn't ever make any sense. I mean, Iraq becomes a fractious country, which will probably never be put back together. You know, then we have Libya. So in that sense, it's permanent war is the goal. And the Ukraine crisis has played quite astutely into that psychosis. In terms of breaking the back of the war industry, the war civilizations, Toynbee writes about this, but I mean, civilizations die through unchecked militarism. I study classics at Harvard. The late Roman Empire was destroyed by the inability to control the Praetorian Guard and the 1 million man army that at the end was literally auctioning off the seat of emperor to the highest bidder. So we had a wing of the Democratic Party, Proxmire, Fulbright, others, that at one point would at least question weapons system. Now they just all, Republican, Democrat, doesn't matter. They're giving more money than they want. So this is why Alexander Berkman called, in World War I, he called the German military the enemy from within. And the military-industrial complex or the war industry is disemboweling the country, quite literally. Seymour Melman writes about this, in that our infrastructure is crumbling, we're They have driven up the debt. I think, what are we paying? I don't know, $300 million a day. I can't remember. But we've lost control. It can't even be audited. And like all militarized late empires, it is that military that's going to crush us. What is the solution? Well, at this point, given the fact that the war industry has captured the media, captured the two major political parties, academia. I mean, I've taught at Princeton, and the robotics department pretty much works for the defense industry. They do all the underwater robotics and get a lot of money for it. It really is going to come to mass mobilization. And we're headed for a really rough winter. Food prices and fuel prices is not as bad as Europe. I mean, UK is talking about an 80% rise in energy bills in October. The unrest, you know, is creating, and the deprivation and the billions of dollars that are being siphoned off to Ukraine is, of course, fuel the rise of this neo-fascism throughout Europe, and not just Europe, in the United States as well.
And that wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.